Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
He is no stranger to city government, having been a part of it and the Chicago schools for years before this. Now Paul Vallas has put his campaign into full speed, and it's time for us to catch up with the man running for mayor. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Former Chicago Public Schools CEO Paul Vallas kicked off his campaign for mayor over a week ago, and he entered a field that's as crowded as you usually see when there's no incumbent in the race. But there's a perception, at least, that Mayor Emanuel is vulnerable for several reasons, and my guest this week is one of the reasons why this may be the political fight of Rahm Emanuel's life. Paul Vallas was budget director under former Mayor Richard M. Daley. Then he was tapped as the first Chicago Public Schools CEO after Daley was given primary control over the schools in 1995. He kept that job until 2001 when he and the mayor had a parting of the ways. Later, he headed school districts in New Orleans, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Philadelphia. He has run for governor and lieutenant governor, and now he is trying to unseat Mayor Emanuel, and he is here. Paul Vallas, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when you launched your campaign, you said the city is in deep trouble. The others who are running in this race have pretty much all said the same thing, and that each has what it takes to get things back under control and moving again. How does anyone rise above the crowd when you have such diverse backgrounds, talents, and in some cases, constituencies among you?
Well, I think what's going to enable me to rise above the crowd are my solutions. And my approach towards dealing with the critical issues that ail the city is to really offer the type of specificity that one would offer if he or she just got elected mayor and they were bringing their proposals before the city council. So I'm going to do that on public safety. In fact, I'm going to do that on Monday beginning, and then I'm going to follow that with a similar presentation on how to address the issue of displaced adults in the community, the 17 to 40-year-olds who are either ex-offenders or TANF recipients or chronically unemployed, et cetera. And I will also have present a policy presentation on comprehensive school reform. I'll do one on pensions. I'll do one on infrastructure. So I think the objective is to take like a week and focus on a specific issue. What are the problems? What are the solutions? And how do you pay for them? And I want to offer that type of specificity because that's been the approach that I've always taken. And I believe if I do that, that will distinguish me from the pack.
But don't you worry that when you do get specific, some people in the public, many people in the public who have now been raised on campaigns that revolve around attack ads and snappy one-liners and taglines might have their eyes glaze over when somebody actually wants to not only talk about the issues, but talk about them in a very detailed way.
Well, you know, let me respond by saying I have never felt that I needed to be condescending to the public. You know, my press conference was an hour. I answered questions for 47 minutes. And I gave substantive answers to the questions that were posed to me. At the end of the day, in every executive job I've had, I've always been very transparent and very open and very detailed in explaining what I was trying to do and how I was trying to do it. And, you know, I've always been able to have great success because I believe that's the public does not want to be condescended to. They're worn out with the cliches or the kind of broad policy statements with no specifics. I think, you know, the key for me is going to be able to get the time, obviously get the airtime, get the media time, have the forums to be able to communicate to people. I believe that if I can clearly identify what my specific proposals are and then provide a lot of detail to back it up, at the very least, people will come away from that presentation or from that discussion with a sense that when I'm offering our real solutions and I've provided the detail to support those solutions, I also intend to literally visit every neighborhood. I've already begun to do that. I'm going to be attending CAPS meetings, block clubs, et cetera. I'm going to be visiting faith-based institutions on virtually every Sunday. I'm going to do what I did when I was superintendent of Chicago Public Schools. When I was superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, I visited 440 schools. And with the exception of the high schools where it's impossible to visit every classroom, I would walk and visit every classroom and introduce myself to every teacher in every classroom, meet the kids, et cetera. I mean, it's that type of grassroots campaign that I'm going to run. And it's going to be me in every neighborhood attending meetings every night. And not only listening to what people have to say, but of equal importance, answering questions, responding to what they're seeking, and answering questions about what I have to offer. And I think if I do that, if I take that grassroots approach, I believe I'll be successful.
The latest candidate to enter the fray is former federal prosecutor Lori Lightfoot, who comes in with a background in criminal justice. She headed the Chicago Police Board and the Mayor's Police Accountability Task Force. Does this growing roster of rivals, and we expect it could grow one or two more
probably
before we're all over, does it fracture the field for people who are against Rahm Emanuel? Doesn't it in some ways guarantee that you're going to scatter the opposition and that it's going to be really a battle for second place?
Well, you know, it was funny because the mayor's spokesman, and you always hear from the mayor's spokesman, made the comment when Lori Lightfoot announced that, you know, that we're all running to be in the runoff. It was almost an admission that Rahm's going to be in a runoff. I believe the mayor's going to be in a runoff. The question is, who's he going to be in a runoff with? I think my chances are very good to be that person. I'd like to win in the first round. I'm certainly going to work very hard to win in the first round. But at the end of the day, I don't care how many, I don't think having this many candidates in the race gives him any sort of advantage. I think what it does for the public is really offer kind of a diversity of ideas and solutions. And some of the candidates will be more detailed than others. But this needs to be an election about solutions. It needs to be an election on that substantive in terms of a serious discussion about the issues facing the city and how we're going to approach addressing those issues. And I think having this large number of candidates, and particularly the caliber of candidates that we have in the race, I think that's what the public's going to get. That's what they want. That's what they're going to receive.
Now, for someone that you say people don't like, Mayor Emanuel's getting a lot of donations. He's reportedly raised almost $3 million, and that figure is climbing. You think you'll need at least $3 million. Where are the donors going to come from? And does having a fundraising, an experienced fundraiser like the mayor start to dry up some of the sources for rival candidates?
Well, look, clearly the mayor's strategy is not to run on his record, but to kind of not scare candidates out of the race, because I don't think his fundraising prowess is going to scare me out of the race. Lori Lightfoot, McCarthy, Wilson, none of us are going to be scared out of the race, I don't believe. But what he's trying to do is he's trying to scare people from giving us contributions. You see what I mean? Because, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I've run into more individuals who basically said, I'd like to give to you, but I can't. I'm afraid. I'm afraid Rahm Emanuel's going to retaliate. Classic case in point. The paramedics in the fire department, they supported Chuy Garcia. It's going on 4 years. They're still waiting for their new ambulances. I mean, they're still working with old equipment, basically because there was retaliation against them. There was retaliation against them because they supported Chuy. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of people intimidated. But I'm not worried about that because I believe that I'll be able to raise enough money in Chicago. And I've done work in many places. I've been involved in raising money for all sorts of causes over the years. So there are people who are not going to be intimidated by Rahm Emanuel and are not going to be afraid to support my campaign. But you know, if my success or failure is going to be driven by money, then I'm not much of a candidate. I mean, I believe that my success will be driven by the fact that I will be able to get enough attention to my very specific solutions to the problems that ail the city, and to my spending time every day in the neighborhoods, attending the meetings that the mayor won't attend, the CAFS meetings, the block club meetings, the community meetings, doing it. You know, the mayor has his own podcast. I basically said, I'll do anyone's podcast. I want every podcast to be my podcast. So I will go out there and try to communicate both in the traditional ways and non-traditional ways to the public introduce myself to people who may not be familiar with my background, but also to reacquaint myself with individuals who know my history and know a little something about my tenure as budget director and school district CEO.
But are you comfortable that you will be able to get your message out, not just with the retail politicking, but you're going to have to go on television, aren't you?
Well, we will go on television, but there's multiple ways to reach the public, as you well know. It's a diversified media market. There are all sorts of ways to communicate with people, and so I think we'll have a very effective strategy. But if you're asking whether or not, look, my goal is to raise between $3 to $5 million. I'm pretty confident I'm going to be able to raise that.
When we have asked the mayor about or his campaign, and those are sometimes two different things, about this field, the response has been that this lineup of challengers is like a political improv show, auditioning cast members, I believe was the quote, while the mayor is focused on improving schools, making streets safer, and bringing jobs to every Chicago neighborhood.
Well, look,
that's what's going on.
he's going to try to say clever things, you know, and because he can't respond by presenting his record of accomplishments, because it's been a record that's lacking. Look, we have more murders in this city than Chicago and then New York and L.A. combined. And I believe that a large part is due to the fact that they've really, in many ways, decimated the police department, not filling critical. We were promised 1,000 police officers. That didn't materialize. They took, by some estimates, well over 1,000 positions out of the budget. They decimated the detectives division. They went from 1,200 detectives to 600 detectives. You know, in New York and L.A., the percentage of police officers who are detectives is 14%, I think, in New York, 15% in L.A. The percentage of police officers who are detectives in this system before the ramp up, because now he's trying to hire. He can't hire police officers fast enough. The problem is they're attriting as fast as he's hiring them. And now he's trying to rebuild the police division, the detectives division. But the detectives division had fallen to 4%. You wonder why you have a clearance rate on shootings of 4% and a clearance rate on murders of 17-18%. Yeah. So at the end of the day, that's not a record you can run on. And let's talk about the schools. Look, because of the hard work of the teachers and the principals, they've been able to weather these continuing financial storms. So test scores have improved, and they improved during Arne Duncan's administration, and they improved during my administration, six consecutive years in reading, five out of 6 years in math. And it's been done despite the fact that you've had four superintendents in 7 years. He finally got it right this time.
So you like Janice Jackson?
Yeah, of course. Yes, I like Janice Jackson. She's an excellent educator. But she's the fourth
quickly,
one.
If you were mayor, would you consider or would you keep her?
Absolutely, absolutely. She's a fine educator, you shouldn't have four cracks at it, so to speak. I mean, what did Daley have? Two superintendents in 16 years, in his last 16 years. But the point is, look what they've done with the school closings. Now, what was the criteria for closing schools? you need the right size of the district, but you can't be closing 50 schools when you're approving the opening of new schools simultaneously. So you're increasing overcapacity, and then you're complaining that overcapacity is the reason why you have to close neighborhood schools. And I don't have a problem in making those type of tough decisions that they need to be made, but you need to have clear criteria before you're ever going to close a school building. And if you are going to close a school building, you need to repurpose that building. Look, there are tens of thousands of individuals in the community, ages 17 to 40, who are ex-offenders, dropouts, chronically unemployed. I mean, you need education and occupational training centers to serve that very population. Why not repurpose those buildings to provide those services? In some cases, that population outnumbers the number of kids in most cases in the neighborhood high school. So the bottom line is, I don't see any evidence of policy. I don't see a strategy for fighting crime in the city, certainly when it comes to providing the critical supports, the resources and supports that the police department needs. I don't see any real education strategy when you look at the way the really callous way they close schools, or the fact that at the time they were closing 50 schools, they were awarding $50 million in no-bid contracts to groups like the Supes Academy, that, incidentally, a group that has sent two superintendents to prison, one in Chicago and one in another city, or $20 million to a politically connected contractor to manage the closing of the schools, or $10 million for some online alternative education program, when you have this very large alternative schools network that I helped create a couple decades ago, serving this displaced population. So I see a total absence of policy, and I see these agencies, whether it's the police department or it's the school district, or being micromanaged by City Hall, not to the betterment of the citizens whose services are intended to benefit.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm political editor Craig Delamore. My guest is former school CEO and a lot of other things, Paul Vallis, who is candidate for mayor of Chicago. You've already given us one idea, and that is about the repurposing the closed schools. But as you said, this is going to be a campaign of ideas. You're getting ready to, and you were saying you were going to do it every week, and I know you delayed because of another announcement that
right.
You were going to do something this past week, but give us another idea. I mean, show us the kind of ideas that people can expect from you.
Sure. All right. Well, you know, let me give you an example. There it's, let's talk about public safety for a second. You know, what I'm going to do on Monday, is to present a plan on providing the police department with the staffing that they need to be effective, to maintain beat integrity, to have the detectives that are, and look, one of the things that I'm going to do on the detective side is not only rebuild the detectives division to 1,200 and reestablish the five divisions that are three. It's kind of crazy to have three divisions that only provides a longer distance of time when it comes to traveling to crime scenes. But I'm going to talk about how to reach out and to bring retired detectives in like they did in New York and other cities, because you can't have a clearance rate of 4% on shootings and 17% and on murders. And, you know, despite their frantic efforts to beef up the detectives division, the detectives that are joining the division don't have a whole lot of experience. So you know, I'm going to talk about staffing. I'm going to talk about resource utilization. I'm going to talk about what needs to be done so that you can maintain the integrity. You can ensure that police officers are not just being pulled from districts randomly to deal with the latest hotspot, but rather you have a core group of officers that are in the districts and that are, if you're going to pay them overtime, you give them overtime to provide more policing in those individual districts. What you need to do is you need to have the support units, the flex units available so that you can target those areas that are high crime without basically robbing Peter to pay Paul. I'm going to talk very specifically specifically about training and about what needs to be done on the training side, and articulate what type of training and indeed redundant training needs to be focused on, so that, you know, because when you're in the military, commanders are evaluated based on their training exercises. That's the first thing that is looked at when you go in. And I was a company commander, and at one time when I was in the Illinois National Guard, and your training plan is constantly scrutinized. And in the military, there's redundant training. People are trained again and again and again on those same tasks, and that redundant training is what brings accountability and effective command and control. So I'm going to talk about those specifics, and then I'm going to talk about this issue of how to create a pipeline so that the next generation of police officers are coming from the neighborhood. So I'll be offering specific detail on all those things, in addition to other things, on Monday when I make my presentation, and I'm going to talk about how it's going to be financed.
I do want to ask something connected to this, but maybe happening, or who knows, maybe it'll happen before there is an election, and that is a consent decree that is being worked out between right now the mayor's office and Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan's office. This is something that's not supported by the Trump administration, but is still going through with the oversight of the federal courts. What do you believe needs to be in that consent decree that would make sense or be vital for doing the kind of police reform that the city needs to see?
Well, you know, let me tell you how you achieve real accountability. You achieve real accountability by making sure that the police have the resources they need, and that they have the training that they need, and that you have the infrastructure, the command and supervisory infrastructure to ensure that there's accountability. Let me give you a case in point. You know, when you're short officers, and those officers are operating many times alone and in isolation, you create the potential for accountability issues. When you have one sergeant for every 30 officers, as opposed to one for every 10, and that was the ratio that we funded when I was city budget director and Terry Hilliard was the police superintendent, you have greater accountability. You know, when you have enough training officers to work with these younger officers, these less experienced officers, you have much greater command and control. You have much greater accountability. When you equip the police officers with the equipment that they need, working cameras, you're not only giving them tasers, but you're giving them training on the tasers. Look how many years it took them to put tasers in the hands of these officers. I mean, how many shootings would not have occurred had that officer been armed with a taser and been trained on the use of the taser? So more important than anything else is you create that infrastructure. You make sure that the police have the resources so that they're not getting worn out, so that the police have enough support. So when there are calls that they have to go to, the backup is there. You make sure that you equip them with all the means available so that there are alternatives to the use of lethal force. You make sure that you have the supervisory structure in place with enough sergeants and the right ratios and enough training officers, so you have that command and control. That's how you build accountability. That's how you prevent the things from happening that have cost the city hundreds of millions of dollars in legal settlements. So I think that takes primacy over everything else.
I want to switch to education, another area you know a little about.
Right.
And I don't want you to tell me all your plans. Well, I do want you to tell me all your plans. Well, frankly, we don't have time.
You know me.
Yeah.
You know.
But elected school board?
I support a hybrid board. And I believe that there needs to be civilian representation. But the mayor has to have skin in the game. You know, I think ultimately if schools aren't working or if schools are not performing, you throw out the mayor. That's the ultimate accountability. But I believe that there needs to be at-large elected school board members so that you have, because the only way that you get real accountability is through transparency. And you're not going to get transparency when you have the mayor appointing every member of the board. So whether it's the police board or the school board, you need public representation. But I think ultimately, whether it's the school superintendent or it's the school board president, or for that matter, the police superintendent, the mayor needs to have the authority to make those decisions.
How do you make sure the citizens are heard and paid attention to?
Well, you know, you do it by giving them a place at the table and giving them access to the information. I mean, if you have at-large members elected to these oversight boards, they're going to have access. There's going to be transparency because you're going to have people who are not beholden to the mayor who are going to be basically who are going to be able to access the information. And by that, in effect, create de facto transparency. And that's not what you have now. But I believe these boards need a level of expertise. And I believe at the end of the day, if crime is out of control, if you have murder rates that exceed the number of murders in L.A. and New York, and if you have a school district that's constantly losing population and is in constant budget crises, I think ultimately the responsibility lies on the fifth floor.
Let's talk about any need for revenue for pensions or anything else. When he was here a couple of weeks ago, Gary McCarthy, one of your rivals for mayor, wanted to consider a casino at O'Hare Airport. First off, what do you think of the idea of casinos in Chicago? And second, what about that airport idea?
Well, I hate to differ, but, I wouldn't support a casino at the airport. And I think casinos are a sideshow. First of all, they're not going to be a financial solution to anything. That's like the lottery. Remember the lottery, the myth of the lottery? You create a lottery, it's going to solve the problems of public education. So, look, if the city gets a casino someday, great. It'll probably help with tourism. I mean, there are some conventions that will come here if there's a casino. But, I wouldn't bet my life on a casino, and I don't see a casino as offering a revenue solution to the problems that ail Chicago. Let me say this. There's going to have to be some revenue increases, but what's really important is the type of revenues we seek. First of all, we need to have an aggressive agenda to make sure that we're getting from the state what we're entitled to. You know, the mayor had 4 years, actually 5 years, to pursue the type of fair funding for the teachers' retirement system that he finally got in 2017 with a Republican governor. Remember, Quinn was governor for 5 years. And that probably cost the city about $1.5 billion in state pension contributions because they failed to go down there with an agenda. In fact, they did go down there with legislation to extend the pension holiday. So the point that I want to make is what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that we get our fair share from the state. And we also have to look at a type of tax and licensing and fee and fine policy that is not totally regressive and that does not punish working families, because that's what we're doing. If you look at the taxes and fees, the increase in property taxes, the red light cameras, which are intended to generate revenue, not improve public safety, it's adversely impacting working families. And I think we have to look at how we raise money, and we have to develop strategies that are going to be more progressive and that lessen the impact on working families, not increase the adverse impact on working families.
That is going to be the final word. Thank you, mayoral candidate Paul Vallas, for spending the time with us.
Good to have
you back.
Thanks for having me.
To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website. That is WBBMNewsRadio.com. Just follow the audio links. You can also find our podcasts on radio.com. I will be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.